From this, it is clear that wisdom and philosophy have taken their beginning from none of the other faculties within us, but from sight, the leader among the senses, which alone, out of the bodily region, God preserved from among the four that were to perish, because the others were enslaved to flesh and the passions of flesh, while sight had the strength to raise its neck, to look upward, and to discover other delights far better than bodily pleasures, from the contemplation of the world and the things in it. It was fitting, then, that sight alone, as out of a league of five cities among the five senses, should obtain a special prize, and, while the others perish, remain, because it does not, like them, confine itself to mortal things, but claims the right to migrate to the imperishable natures, rejoicing in the sight of these. For this reason, the oracles most beautifully represent this city as both small and not small. Cf. Gen 19, 20, hinting at sight. For it is called small because it is a slight part of what is within us, but great because it reaches after great things, longing to gaze upon the whole heaven and the world. Concerning, then, the vision that appeared and the celebrated and altogether beautiful gifts of hospitality, in which the host who seemed to be entertaining was himself the one entertained, we have made clear, as far as was possible, an exact account of what pertains to that scene. But we must not pass over in silence the greatest deed worthy to be heard, for I am not far from saying that it surpasses all deeds pleasing to God. We must speak of what is essential concerning it. A son is born to the sage from his wedded wife, legitimate, beloved, and only most beautiful in body and best in soul. For already, at his tender age, he was displaying virtues more mature than his years, so that his father was moved not only by the natural affection of a father, but also by judgment, like a judge of character, to a strong tenderness of love. While he was in this state, suddenly an oracle is pronounced, never hoped for, that he should sacrifice his son upon some very high hill at a distance of 3 days' journey from the city. But he, though hanging upon his boy with an inexpressible longing, neither changed color nor was bent in soul, but remained unshaken, with unyielding and unwavering resolve, just as he had been before. And, overpowered by a divine love, he conquered utterly all the names and endearments of kinship, and, telling the oracle to none of his household, taking from his many household servants only the two oldest and most devoted to their master, he set out as a fourth with his son, as though for some customary sacred rite. And having seen the appointed place from far off, as if from a watchtower, he bids the servants remain behind, and gives to his son fire and wood to carry, deeming it right that the victim itself should be burdened with what pertained to the sacrifice, a most light burden, for nothing is less toilsome than piety. Walking at an equal pace, no more with their bodies than with their minds, along the shortest road, whose end is holiness, they arrive at the appointed place. Then the father began gathering stones to build an altar, while the son, seeing everything else made ready for the sacred rite, but no animal, looked at his father and said, "Here is the fire and the wood, father, but where is the victim?" Another man, knowing what he was about to do and darkening it in his soul at what had been said, would have been thrown into confusion, and, filled with tears, would have betrayed, through the intensity of his feeling, by his very calm, a hint of what was to come. But he, admitting no change either in body or in mind, with a steady gaze and steady reasoning, says in answer to the question, "My child, God will see to a victim for himself, even in this great desolation, on account of which perhaps you despair of one being found. But know that all things are possible to God, even those that lie beyond human resource and contrivance." And saying this, he quickly snatched up his son, laid him on the altar, drew the sword with his right hand, and brought it down to slay him. But the saving God anticipated the deed, cutting it short with a voice from the air that commanded him to hold back and not touch the boy, calling the father by name twice, so that he might turn and pull back his hand and stop himself from carrying out the slaughter. And so the son was kept safe, God giving him back as a gift in return, and honoring the one who brought him in the very act by which he had shown his piety. And for the father, the deed itself, even though it was not carried through to its end, has been engraved whole and complete not only in the sacred books, but also in the minds of those who read them from that time on. But to those who love to give offense and find fault with everything, who are in the habit of prizing blame above praise, the deed done does not seem great and marvelous, as we suppose it to be. For they say that many others too, among men most devoted to their households and their children, have given up their own sons, some to be slaughtered on behalf of their homelands, to serve as ransom against wars or droughts or floods or plagues of disease, others on behalf of some observance held to be pious, even if it was not truly so. Among the Greeks, the most highly regarded, not private citizens only but kings as well, gave little thought to those they had begotten, and by putting them to death, saved great and populous armies drawn up as allies, while on the enemy's side, they destroyed at a single stroke. And barbarian nations for a long time accepted the killing of children as a holy and God-pleasing act, of whose pollution the most holy Moses himself makes mention. For accusing them of this defilement, he says that they burn their sons and their daughters to their gods. Deut. 12:31. And among the Indians, the naked sages to this day, whenever the long and incurable disease of old age begins to take hold, before it has firmly mastered them, heap up a pyre and burn themselves upon it, though they might perhaps still hold out for many more years. And it has happened that women too, when their husbands have died before them, rush gladly to the same pyre, and while still alive, endure being burned along with their husbands' bodies. One might reasonably admire these acts for their sheer daring, holding death in such utter contempt, as though rushing toward immortality and running to it without pausing for breath. But why should this man be praised as the originator of some newly invented deed, when private citizens and kings and whole nations do the same at various times? To the envy and bitterness of such people, I will say this. Of those who sacrifice a child, some do it out of custom, as I said certain barbarians do. Others do it because of unwanted and grave circumstances of cities and countries that cannot be set right in any other way, of whom some give up their own children under compulsion, forced by those more powerful, while others do it out of a craving for reputation and honor, for glory in the present and good report in time to come. Those, then, who sacrifice by custom do nothing great, it seems. For custom, grown habitual over time, is often equated with nature, so that it lightens even things hard to endure and hard to bear, making the extremes of what is fearful easy to manage. And for those who give up their children out of fear, there is no praise at all. For praise is recorded for voluntary achievements, while unwilling acts belong to other categories, whether to circumstance, or to fortune, or to compulsions imposed by other men. And if someone, reaching for glory, gives up a son or a daughter, he would justly be blamed rather than praised, purchasing honor at the price of death for those most dear to him, an honor which, even once gained, he ought to have thrown away for the sake of saving his children. We must inquire, then, whether that man was about to sacrifice his son because he was overcome by any of the things just mentioned, custom, honor, or fear. As for custom, Babylon and Mesopotamia and the Chaldean nation do not accept the killing of children, and it was among them that he was raised and lived for most of his life, so that by the constant repetition of such acts he might be thought to have been mastered, his perceptions of what is terrible dulled. And certainly there was no fear from other men, for no one even knew of the oracle given to him alone, nor had some common disaster overtaken them, one whose remedy required the killing of his most highly esteemed son. But was it that, hunting for the praise of the many, he rushed toward the deed? And what praise could there be in the wilderness, with no one present who was going to applaud what was to happen, indeed with even the two servants deliberately left far behind, so that he should not seem to be showing off and putting on display, calling in witnesses of his piety? Let those with unbridled and slanderous mouths, then, shut their doors and moderate the envy that hates the good within them, and let them not injure the virtues of men who have lived well, virtues which it would be fitting to honor with good report instead. And that the deed is in truth praiseworthy and worthy of love is easy to see from many considerations. First, then, obedience to God, which is held in reverence and eagerly contested for among all who think rightly, he cultivated above all else, so that he never once disregarded any command, without reluctance or displeasure, even when it was full of toil and pain. And this is why he bore what was decreed concerning his son with the utmost nobility and firmness. Next, since there was no custom in his country, as there perhaps is among some peoples, of sacrificing human beings, a practice which constant repetition tends to weaken one's perception of as something terrible, he himself was about to be the first to begin so novel and extraordinary a deed, one which I think no one would have endured even if his soul had been forged of iron or adamant. For as someone has said, it is nature's way to resist. And having made this son alone his legitimate child, he possessed at once in him a legitimate depth of affection as well, surpassing even the most temperate loves and the friendships that come about through mere acquaintance. And there was added a most compelling charm, that he had begotten the boy not in the prime of life, but in old age. For fathers who are wild with affection for children born late in life feel this either because they had longed for the birth through a long stretch of time, or because they no longer expect any others to come, nature having come to a halt there as at its final and utmost limit. Now to give up one child out of many to God, as a kind of first fruits of one's children, is nothing extraordinary, since one still has the pleasures found in those who remain, no small comfort and balm for the grief over the one sacrificed. But a man who gives up the only son he holds dear accomplishes a deed greater than any account can capture, granting nothing to kinship, but inclining the whole balance of his soul toward what is pleasing to God. That indeed is exceptional, and something done by this man almost alone. For others, even when they give up their own children to be slaughtered for the safety of their homelands or their armies, either remain at home or stand far off from the altars, or, even if they happen to be present, turn their eyes away, unable to bear watching, while others do the killing. But he, like a priest, himself began the sacred rite, though he was the most affectionate of fathers toward a son who was in every way the best, and he would perhaps even have cut his son limb from limb according to the law of whole burnt offerings, cf. Lev. 1, 6 and elsewhere, performing the sacrifice member by member. So it was not that one part of him inclined toward his child and another toward piety, but that he devoted his whole soul entirely to holiness, giving little thought to the blood of his own kin. What then, in what has been said, is common to others? What is not exceptional and beyond all account? So that even one not naturally envious and hostile to what is good would be struck with amazement at his excessive piety, even without taking in all at once everything I have said, but even a single one of these points. For even the impression of a single instance, in a brief sketch, and nothing that is the work of a wise man is brief, is enough to display greatness and loftiness of soul. But the things said do not stop at their plain and evident meaning. Rather, they seem to hint at a deeper nature, less clear to most people, which those who value the intelligible above the perceptible, and who are able to see it, recognize. It is like this. The one who was about to be sacrificed is called in Chaldean Isaac, but when the name is translated into Greek, laughter. Laughter here does not mean the kind that arises in the body through jesting, but rather the good feeling and joy that belongs to the mind. This is the offering that the wise man is said, fittingly, to perform for God through a symbol, signifying that rejoicing belongs to God alone as his very own. For the human race is subject to grief and fear, whether from present evils or those expected, so that it is either pained by unwanted things at hand or shaken with turmoil and fear at what is to come. But the nature of God is free from grief and fear and untouched by any passion, alone partaking of perfect happiness and blessedness. To the one who has made this true confession, God, being kind and benevolent in his way, having driven envy from himself, fittingly gives the gift in return, in proportion to the capacity of the one who is to receive it, and all but proclaims these very words. That the kind of joy that is rejoicing belongs to no one but me, the Father of all, this I know clearly. Yet though I possess it, I do not begrudge its use to those who are worthy. And who could be worthy, except one who follows me and my purposes? For it will fall to him, least of all, to be pained, and least of all to be afraid, as he travels this road, which is impassable to the passions and vices, but is walked through by good feelings and virtues. Let no one suppose that unmixed joy, free of all admixture of grief, descends from heaven to earth. Rather, it is mixed of both, with the better element predominating, just as light in heaven is unmixed and free of darkness, but appears mixed with murky air among things beneath the moon. For this reason, it seems to me, Sarah, surnamed Virtue, having laughed earlier, denied her laughter to the one who inquired, Gen 18? 15. Fearing that she might be appropriating for herself the rejoicing that belongs to no created being but to God alone. And so, to reassure her, the sacred word says, Do not be afraid, you did truly laugh, and joy is yours. For the Father did not allow the human race to be swept along wholly by griefs and pains and unbearable burdens, but mixed in something of the better nature too, deeming it right that the soul should at times find fair weather and calm. And he willed that the wise should rejoice and be glad, for the greater part of their lives, in the contemplation of the works of the universe. Let this much be said about the man's piety, even though there is an abundance of much else that could be told. We must also examine his kindness toward his fellow human beings, for it belongs to the same nature to be pious and to love humanity, and each of these is observed in relation to the same object, holiness toward God, justice toward human beings. To recount all his deeds would take too long, but it is not out of place to recall two or three. Though he was among the wealthiest in silver and gold, and possessed flocks teeming with many kinds of livestock, and rivaled the natives and the indigenous people who had ample possessions in his abundance, and had become richer than befits a resident alien, he was blamed by none of his hosts, but was praised continually by all who came to know him. And if ever, as often happens, some rivalry or quarrel arose between his servants and companions and others, he would try to dissolve it quietly, having set before it his weightier character, having driven from his soul all that was contentious, turbulent, and factious. And it is no wonder that he behaved this way toward strangers, who, joining forces with a heavier and stronger hand, would have retaliated against one who began an unjust affray. When even toward those who were kin by birth, but estranged in disposition, isolated and alone, and possessing far less than he acted with moderation, willingly accepting the lesser share in matters where he could have had the greater. For he had a nephew who had gone out with him when he left his homeland, unsteady, wavering, leaning now this way now that, at one time fawning with friendly greetings, at another rebelling, and throwing off restraint on account of the unevenness of his character. Hence his household, too, was quarrelsome and turbulent, having no one to discipline it, and especially the shepherds, who were kept far from their master. Being self-willed, like freedmen, they were constantly at odds with the overseers of the wise man's flocks, who mostly yielded on account of their master's gentle disposition. Emboldened by this toward recklessness and shameless insolence, they grew angry, and kept the fire of their implacable resentment burning within themselves, until they forced those who were wronged to rush to defend themselves. When a very fierce battle had broken out, the good man, hearing of the counterattack, and knowing that his own side was superior in numbers and strength, would not let the dispute go all the way to victory, so as not to grieve his nephew by the defeat of his own men. But standing on the border, he reconciled the disputants with words of settlement, not only for the present time, but for the time to come as well. For knowing that if they continued to live together and share the same dwelling, they would, out of stubborn rivalry, forever stir up factions and wars against each other. In order to prevent this, he judged it advantageous to give up their common life and separate their households. And summoning his nephew, he gave him the choice of the better land, gladly agreeing that whichever portion he chose he should have, for he considered peace itself the greatest gain. And yet who else, being the stronger, would yield to a weaker man in any matter whatsoever? Who, being able to win, would wish to be defeated, rather than make use of his power? He alone, placing the highest good not in strength and greed for advantage, but in a life free of faction, and, so far as it depended on him, in tranquility, seemed to all the most admirable of men. Since, then, this praiseworthy account has been given as concerning a man, and since character types of the soul are also signified, according to those who proceed from the literal to the intelligible, it would be fitting to search these out as well. Countless types, indeed, arise from countless starting points, in keeping with all sorts of forms of things, but there are two that are now to be examined, of which one is older and the other younger. The older being the one that honors what is first and ruling by nature, the younger the one that honors what is subordinate and found at the outermost limits. The older and ruling things, then, are prudence, self-control, justice, courage, and everything belonging to virtue, and to actions in accordance with virtue. The younger are wealth, reputation, office, and noble birth, not the true kind, but the kind the many suppose it to be, and whatever else has been assigned the third rank after the things of soul and body, which is immediately also the last. Each of these two types, then, has what might be called flocks and herds. The one who reaches for external things has silver, gold, garments, and everything that serves as material and equipment for wealth, and again weapons, engines of war, warships, cavalry, infantry, and naval power, the resources for dominion, from which secure mastery results. While the one who loves nobility of character has the doctrines belonging to each virtue and the contemplations of wisdom itself. Over each of these two, there are overseers and caretakers, like shepherds over their flocks. Over the external things, those who love money and reputation and aspire to command, and all who delight in holding power over the masses. Over the things of the soul, those who love beauty and love virtue, choosing not the spurious goods before the genuine, but the genuine before the spurious. A kind of natural conflict, then, arises between them, since they agree on nothing, but are ever discordant and at variance concerning the matter that holds together all of life more than any other, namely, the judgment of what is truly good. For a while, then, the soul was warred upon and went along with this faction, not yet fully purified, but with the passions and diseases still getting the better of the healthy reasonings. But from the time it began to grow stronger, and with a mightier strength, to tear down the fortifications of the opposing opinions, having taken wing and having been filled with high resolve, it walls off and separates from itself the character type that had marveled at external material things. And, as though addressing a man, it says, "It is impossible for you to live together and share the same table with one who is a lover of wisdom and virtue. Go, then, remove yourself and be separated far away, having no fellowship with him, indeed, being unable to have any. For whatever you suppose to be on the right hand, he considers to be on the left. And whatever, on the contrary, you suppose to be on the left, is held by him to be on the right." The good man, then, was not only peaceable and a lover of justice, but courageous and warlike as well, not for the sake of waging war, for he was not quarrelsome or contentious, but for the sake of securing a lasting peace for the future, which his adversaries were destroying. The clearest proof is what he actually did. Four great kings had been allotted the eastern portion of the inhabited world, and the eastern nations obeyed them, both those beyond the Euphrates and those within it. Everything else remained free of rebellion, submitting to the king's commands and paying the annual tribute without objection. Only the territory of the Sodomites, before it was burned to the ground, began to unsettle the peace, having long been minded to revolt. For since this land was extremely prosperous, five kings held power over it, having divided the cities and the territory among themselves, not extensive in area, but rich in grain and trees and overflowing with fruit. What great size gave to other lands, virtue gave to Sodom, and this is why its beauty won it so many admirers among rulers who were struck with astonishment at it. For a long while, these five kings paid the tribute imposed on them to the collectors of revenue, honoring and at the same time fearing those who were mightier than themselves, whose governors they were. But when they had their fill of good things, and, as usually happens, satiety bred arrogance, thinking more highly of their own power than was warranted, they first shook off the yoke. And then, like wicked slaves who attack their own masters, they set upon them, trusting in rebellion rather than in strength. The four kings, remembering their own noble birth and arming themselves with a mightier force, advanced very contemptuously, as though they would prevail with a single shout. And when they engaged, they scattered some at once into flight, while others they cut down as they turned to run, destroying them to the last man of fighting age. And having taken a great crowd of captives together with the rest of the plunder, they divided it among themselves. They also carried off the wise man's nephew, who not long before had moved to one of the cities of the Pentapolis. When this was reported by one of those who had survived the rout, it distressed him grievously, and he could no longer rest, being thrown into confusion by it, and grieving over him as living was more painful than if he had learned that he was dead. For the end, as its very name somewhere shows, he knew to be the termination of everything in life, and especially of evils, but countless unwanted things lie in wait for the living. As he made ready to pursue in order to rescue his nephew, he was at a loss for allies, since he was a foreigner and a resident alien, and no one dared to oppose the irresistible forces of so many kings, kings moreover who had just been victorious. But he discovered a most novel form of alliance, for a way is found even in the midst of impossibility, whenever a person sets his heart on works of justice and humanity. He gathered together his household servants, and having ordered those he had purchased with money to remain at home, for he feared desertion from among them, he enrolled those born in his household, and dividing them into companies of 100, he advanced in 3 divisions, trusting not in these forces, for they were a tiny fraction compared with those of the kings, but in God, the champion and defender who fights on behalf of justice. So he pressed on, straining every effort and relaxing none of his speed, until, watching for his moment, he fell upon the enemy by night, when they had already dined and were about to turn to sleep. And some he slaughtered in their beds, while those who formed ranks against him he destroyed utterly, and he overpowered them all with vigor, relying more on the courage of his soul than on his equipment. And he did not relent until he had cut down the opposing army to the last man of fighting age, along with the kings themselves, and had laid them low before their own camp, and had brought his nephew back after a brilliant and most conspicuous victory, taking along with him, besides all the cavalry and the multitude of other pack animals, and a most abundant plunder. When the great priest of the greatest god saw him returning, bearing the trophies of victory, safe himself and with his own force safe, for he had lost not one of his companions, he was struck with astonishment at the magnitude of the achievement, and, reflecting as one naturally would that it could not have been accomplished without divine providence and alliance, he lifted up his hands to heaven, honored him with prayers, offered sacrifices for the victory, and gave a splendid feast for all who had shared in the struggle, rejoicing and delighting in it as though it were his own achievement. And in truth it was his own, for, as the proverb has it, friends hold all things in common, and far more so do good men, whose single aim is to please God. These, then, are the things the literal scriptures contain. But those who are able to contemplate matters as incorporeal and stripped bare, who live by the soul rather than by the body, will say that of the 9 kings, 4 represent the powers within us of the 4 passions, pleasure, desire, fear, and grief, while the 5 represent the equal number of senses, sight, hearing, taste, smell, and touch. For in a certain way these hold royal sway and rule over us, having power fastened upon them, though not in the same degree. For the 5 are subject to the 4 and pay them the tribute, and dues that nature has made obligatory. For it is from what we see or hear, or smell or taste or touch, that griefs and pleasures and fears and desires arise, none of the passions having any strength of its own, unless it were supplied by the equipment furnished through the senses. For these are the powers belonging to those passions, whether through colors and shapes, or through the voice in speaking or hearing, or through flavors or through sense, or through the qualities found in tangible things, soft and hard, or rough and smooth, or hot and cold. For all these are supplied to each of the passions through the senses. And so long as the tribute mentioned is paid, alliance remains among the kings, but whenever it is no longer rendered in the same measure, factions and wars immediately arise. This is likely to happen when painful old age arrives, in which none of the passions grows any weaker, indeed perhaps even mightier than their former strength. But the eyes grow dim, the ears hard of hearing, and each of the other senses more blunted, no longer able to discern each thing as precisely nor to render judgment, nor to pay tribute equal to what is due. It is reasonable, then, that having grown weak in every way, they are easily overturned by the opposing passions, which incline against them of their own accord. Most naturally has it been said that of the 5 kings, 2 fall into pits, while 3 set out in flight, Gen 14:10. For touch and taste reach down to the deepest recesses, conveying what belongs to them into the inward parts for their governance, while the eyes, ears, and smell, mostly moving outward, escape the body's servitude. Watching over all these, the man of worth, when he saw the allied and friendly powers lately diseased, and war arising in place of peace among the 9 kingdoms, with the five contending against the four for supremacy of rule, suddenly seized his moment and attacked, ambitious to establish in the soul democracy. The best of constitutions, in place of tyrannies and dynasties, and lawfulness and justice, in place of the lawlessness and injustice that had until then prevailed. What has been said is no fictional myth, but a matter observed among the truest realities within ourselves. For often the senses maintain harmony with the passions, supplying to them the objects of sense, and often too they fall into faction, no longer willing to pay the same due, or unable to, because reason, the corrective power, is present. Whenever reason takes up its own full armor, the virtues, and the doctrines and contemplations belonging to them, a power that cannot be resisted, it prevails most mightily, for it is not lawful for the perishable to dwell together with the imperishable. The nine dominions, then, of the four passions and the five senses are perishable and causes of destruction, while reason, which uses the virtues as its base of operations, is truly sacred and divine, ranked in the number of the perfect 10. And when it comes to the contest, employing the mightier power that is according to God, it conquers utterly the dominions just described. In time, later, his wife died, a woman most agreeable in temper and best in every respect, having given countless proofs of her devotion to her husband. Her abandonment of her kinsfolk along with him, her unhesitating removal from her homeland, her continual and repeated wanderings in a foreign land, her want and hunger, her campaigns alongside him in wars. For always and everywhere she was at his side, leaving no place or occasion, a true partner of his life and of the affairs of that life, claiming an equal share both in good things and in bad. For she was not like some women who flee from misfortune while lying in wait for good fortune, but she embraced with all eagerness whatever portion fell to her in either case, as fitting and proper for a wife. Though I have many things to relate in praise of this woman, I will call to mind one, which will serve as the clearest proof of the others as well. Being childless and barren, and fearing that the house beloved of God might be left utterly bereft of offspring, she came to her husband and said the following: "For a long time now we have lived together, well pleased with one another, but the begetting of children, for the sake of which we ourselves came together, and for which nature joined the partnership of husband and wife, has not occurred, nor is it to be expected in the future from me, since I am already past the age. Do not, then, be deprived, on account of my barrenness, of the benefit that is your due, nor, out of your goodwill toward me, be barred from becoming a father when you are able to be one. For I would feel no jealousy toward another woman, since you would not be taking her out of irrational desire, but in order to fulfill a necessary law of nature. For this reason I will not delay to escort a bride to you, one who is to fill up what is lacking in me. And if the prayers for the begetting of children should be answered, the offspring will be legitimately yours, but by adoption entirely mine as well. For this reason I will not delay to give her to you as a bride, since she is to fulfill what is lacking in me. And if the prayers concerning the begetting of children should be answered, the children born will be yours by nature, but certainly mine by adoption. And so that there be no suspicion of jealousy on my part, take, if you wish, my own maidservant, a slave in body, but free and noble in mind, whose character I have tested and proved over a long time, from the very day she was first brought into my household, Egyptian by birth, but Hebrew by choice. We possess much property and abundant wealth, not as resident aliens do. Indeed, we already surpass the native-born in splendid good fortune. But no heir or successor has yet been appointed, if you will be persuaded by my advice." And he, moved still more by his wife's ever-active and ardent devotion to her husband, and by her careful forethought concerning the future, took to himself the woman she had approved, continuing with her, as the most accurate accounts say, only until she had conceived. For once she had conceived, not long after, he abstained from her, both out of natural self-restraint and out of the honor he accorded his wedded wife. So a son is born from the maidservant, though it might have happened at that very time in any case, and long afterward, a legitimate son is born as well, to a couple who had given up hope of having children of their own. God, who delights in giving, granting a reward for their nobility more complete than any hope. Let this much suffice as examples told concerning the woman. But there are yet more praises to speak of the sage, some of which I recounted a little earlier. I will also tell of his conduct at his wife's death, a deed not fit to be passed over in silence. For having lost such a partner in the whole of life as our account has shown and the oracles attest, when grief was already stripping down and covering itself with dust to grapple with his soul, like an athlete he prevailed, strengthening and greatly encouraging reason, the natural opponent of the passions. And using reason as his counselor throughout his whole life, he judged it right at that time above all to be persuaded by it, as it urged upon him what was best and beneficial. And these were its counsels, neither to thrash about beyond due measure, as though the calamity were utterly novel and unprecedented, nor to display such indifference as though nothing painful had occurred, but to choose the mean between the two extremes and try to moderate one's feelings, not resenting nature for reclaiming what was owed to it, but bearing what had happened calmly and gently easing it. Testimony to this is recorded in the sacred books, which it is not lawful to convict of false witness. They report that after shedding a few tears over the body, he rose quickly from beside the corpse, evidently considering excessive mourning foreign to wisdom, the wisdom that had taught him to regard death not as the extinction of the soul, but as its separation and release from the body, the soul departing back to the place from which it came. And it came, as has been shown in the treatise on the creation of the world, from God. Just as no one would be distressed at repaying a debt or a deposit to the one who lent it, in the same way he thought one ought not to be angry when nature reclaims what belongs to it, but should welcome what is necessary. When the leading men of the region came to share in his grief, and saw none of the customary displays made for mourners among them, no wailing, no lamentation, no beating of the breast, neither from men nor from women, but a steady and sober dejection pervading the whole household, they were greatly astonished, though they had already been struck with wonder at the rest of the man's life. Then, unable to contain within themselves the greatness and beauty of his virtue, for everything about it was extraordinary, they came forward and cried out, "You are a king from God among us." Gen 23:6, speaking the plain truth. For other kingships are established by men, through wars and campaigns and countless evils, which those who lust after power inflict on one another as they slaughter each other, arraying infantry, cavalry, and naval forces against one another. But the kingship of the sage is bestowed by God, and the excellent man who receives it becomes the cause of harm to no one, while proclaiming to all his subjects peace and good order, together with the acquisition and enjoyment of good things. There is also a written praise of him, attested in the oracles that Moses was inspired to declare, by which it is revealed that he believed God. Gen 15:6, a statement briefest to utter, but greatest to confirm indeed. For in whom else ought one to place trust? Is it in positions of power, or in reputation and honors, or in abundance of wealth and noble birth, or in health and keenness of the senses, or in bodily strength and beauty? But every form of rule is precarious, having countless rivals lying in ambush against it, and even where it is somehow secured, it is secured only along with the countless evils that those in power both inflict and suffer. Reputation and honors are a most precarious possession, tossed about on the unstable characters and fickle words of thoughtless people. And even if they should endure, they do not by nature contain any genuine good. Wealth and noble birth belong even to the most worthless people, and even if they belonged only to the excellent, they would be praises of one's ancestors and of fortune, not of those who possess them. But it is not worth taking pride in bodily qualities either, in which the irrational animals have the advantage. For what man is stronger or mightier than the bull among tame creatures or the lion among wild ones? Who is sharper sighted than the hawk or the eagle? Who is so fortunate in hearing as the donkey, the most sluggish of animals? Who is more precise in smell than the dog, which hunters say tracks by scent and runs unerringly toward carcasses far away that it has never seen? For what sight is to others, the nostrils are to hunting and tracking dogs. Most of the irrational animals are also the healthiest and, as far as possible, the most free from disease. And in the contest of beauty, it seems to me that even some lifeless things can win and surpass the fair forms of both men and women. Statues, carved images, and paintings, and in general all the works of painting and sculpture successfully achieved in either art, over which Greeks and barbarians alike take such pains, for the adornment of their cities, setting them up in the most prominent places. So the only unfailing and secure good is faith toward God. The consolation of life, the fulfillment of good hopes, barrenness of evils and abundance of goods, the renunciation of misfortune, the knowledge of piety, the inheritance of happiness, the improvement of the soul in every respect, once it has fixed and settled itself firmly upon the cause of all things, who is able to do all things and wills only what is best. For just as those who walk along a slippery road trip and fall, while those who go by a dry and well-traveled highway make their journey without stumbling, so too those who lead the soul by way of bodily things and externals accustom it to nothing but falling, for these things are slippery and the most unstable of all. While those who hasten toward God through the contemplations that concern the virtues keep to a safe and unshaken path. So that it can be said with utmost truth that the one who trusts in those things distrusts God, while the one who distrusts those things has put his trust in God. But the oracles do not only attest his faith in the existent one, the Queen of Virtues, they also declared him the first to be called Elder. Gen 24:1, even though those before him had lived three times as many years and more, none of whom, as far as we have learned, was deemed worthy of this title. And this is surely fitting. For one who is elder in truth is recognized not by length of years, but by a praiseworthy and perfect life. Those, then, who have worn away a long span of time in life with the body, without nobility of character, should rightly be called long-lived children, never having learned the lessons worthy of gray hair. Whereas one who has come to love wisdom, understanding, and faith in God might justly be called an elder, taking his name alongside the first. For in truth the sage is first among the human race, just as the pilot is first on a ship, the ruler first in a city, the general first in war, the soul is first in the body, mind first in the soul, and again heaven is first in the universe, and God is first in heaven. God, admiring the man's faith toward him, gives faith back to him in return, the confirmation by oath of the gifts he had promised, no longer speaking merely as God to a man, but as a friend conversing with an acquaintance. For he says, I have sworn by myself. Gen 22:16. He for whom his word is itself an oath, in order that Abraham's mind might be established still more unwaveringly and firmly than before. The good and excellent man, then, is and should be called elder and first, while every fool is younger and last, pursuing the things that make for novelty and are ranked at the very margins. Let this much, then, be said on this subject. And setting, as it were, a crowning capstone upon the multitude and greatness of the sages' praises, Moses says that this man did the divine law and all the divine commandments. Gen 26:5, not having been instructed by written texts, but having taken pains to follow unwritten nature with sound and healthy impulses. And concerning what God himself confesses, what is fitting for men to do but believe most firmly? Such is the life of the first founder of the nation, a life that some will call lawful, but that my own account has shown to be law itself, an unwritten statute.